Ahoy, ahoy, everybody. Welcome to another interview episode of Talking Simpsons. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, who is here with me.
Henry Gilbert, lover of twiddly fingers.
That's right, I do too. And guess what, guys? Today we're talking to David freaking Silverman, one of the founding fathers of The Simpsons, in my eyes, at least.
I'd say he's at least the Ben Franklin of it.
I don't know. Or the Button Gwinnett. He wrote The Simpsons Constitution. In case you don't know who he is, he was with the show from the shorts onwards. He was gone from the show from seasons 9 to 12, but he is such a fundamental part of the look of the show and some of the best episodes of the show, too. He directed himself.
He had worked very hard on the shorts. He had worked, he became supervising director in season 4. Some of his directed episodes include the first aired episode, The Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire, Homie the Clown, The Treehouse of Horror 4, Mother Simpson.
Yes, so many good ones. So yes, he goes back quite a ways with the show, obviously. He's been sort of working on it for 30 years, so we got a lot of great stories out of him, including, like, I think a huge chunk of our interview was just talking about the shorts and how those went down, because, you know, not a lot is really known about them. People don't really talk about the shorts anymore.
No way, yeah. And Bob and I had just rewatched the shorts, too, in the last year. In the last 4 months, we've seen them all again. And so they were definitely on our minds as well. And it's something like the shorts, you can't even, they are not on a DVD.
No.
Like, so it's just fun to re-explore them. And I got to give it to David. He had such whip snap memory on all that stuff. Like he remembered it all. I was sure he wouldn't know. I was like, well, I'm ready for him to not remember this like it was 32 years ago, but he knew it all, man.
He's a super brain genius. So yes, thank you so much for supporting us, and here is the interview. So we want to start off by asking about the Tracy Ullman show short, and specifically how the team came together and what that world was like, that world of animation in 1987.
Well, it's very interesting. It's a great question. Let's go back further. Let's go to 1985, 86, where animation, as far as my vantage point, seemed like it was not a very vibrant field. There wasn't a lot really going on. There was more or less Saturday morning. There was commercial work. Even Disney hadn't quite, gotten back up on its feet. And we didn't have nearly amount of information to know what was going on behind the scenes. Obviously, clearly there was no internet, but even, entertainment reporting wasn't like it is today. So there wasn't a lot to gauge or to know what was happening. It seemed like a tough time to be in the animation business, and I had just gotten out of UCLA in 1984, and I was bumping around on different things. I was freelancing illustration and cartoon drawing work and animation, and I was actually kind of wavering. Do I want to stick with animation, or do I want to become more of a freelance cartoonist? But I was fortunate. I met this great guy from CalArts named Bill Kopp, and he was working with Savage Steve Holland. Mm-hmm. And he worked on one film called Better Off Dead, which you may recall, John Cusack. And in it, he plays like a young cartoonist at high school. And his drawings come to life in one sequence. And then there was a film that had more animation. It was called One Crazy Summer. And that was a film that Bill got me involved in like around late August of 85. And I worked on the animation portion. There's about 10 minutes of animation in this live action film. Mr. Rhino and the Cute and Fuzzy Bunnies, who get, attacked in very cute and funny and violent ways. And so one of the other members of the team was Wes Archer, along with Tim Bjerglund and Jeff Myers. And it was the five of us doing the animation and the cleanup, actually, as well. We sort of switched off back and forth. Now, Wes Archer, he had worked from time to time, once or twice, he'd freelance for a small company called Klasky Csupo. Now, Gabor Csupo and Arlene Klasky met, and they were married at the time, and they opened their small production studio, mostly doing what is known as motion graphics. This is sort of before, really, a lot of CG stuff. And motion graphics were like, sort of like floating letters with glints and things like that. If you remember those from the looking at old commercials from the 80s and even into the 90s. And that was achieved by a Oxbury animation camera that had motion control on it, in the sense that you could do truck downs and repeat the action, exactly on the film. And it would be multiple exposures to create these sort of effects that were done by hand and backlits and glows and things like that multiple times. Sort of the same way that Star Wars would shoot a model over and over again, you know, the same path of action, and one time to be the action of the body and then the lights and so forth. But that's what they mostly did. Occasionally, they would do some character animation commercial or something like that, and they had hired Wes to do one or two of these. Well, they got the contract to do the animation for something called the Tracy Ullman Show. And, you know, none of us had heard of Tracy Ullman, but we had heard of James L. Brooks, and we had heard of Matt Groening, because we were all big fans of Life in Hell comics that were in the paper and in the Free Weekly. And that seemed worthwhile. I thought, well, maybe I'd like to animate on that. Because, see, I actually was at a kind of a crossroads. I had made a decision after One Crazy Summer. You know what? I'm going to focus on illustration. Not that I'm going to leave animation per se, but I'm going to spend the year of 1987 and just focus on my own style. I'd saved up enough money to basically live off for a year, and I was just going to focus on my own style, like practice, like every day from 9 to 5, just sort of draw and draw and draw and see what shakes out. This is a suggestion of an old college friend, Gary Baseman, who's now a very famous fine artist, but by then he was a very successful commercial illustrator, and he made that suggestion that I do that. So that was my plan for 1987. Instead, I decided to work on the Tracy Ullman Show.
I remember watching One Crazy Summer as a kid and being disappointed when the cartoon stopped. I was like, I thought I wanted to see more of these cartoons.
Me too, actually.
Well, we actually had more animation. We actually had an entire song to James Taylor's song Gorilla, as a little romantic animation of the Rhino character and a caricature of Demi Moore, you know, having like this whole, like, it was basically like a mini music video, and that was sort of the idea, but they cut it, and we animated it. We actually animated it. I think we painted it even.
Wow.
And it was really kind of cool. We painted half of it, and I said, and that's when the producer said, cut out more of that cartoon stuff. Because they were too old or too full of cocaine to understand it was entertaining.
Probably both.
Well, so, as Grandpa Simpson would say, a little from column A, a little from column B.
Well, so Bob and myself just rewatched all of the shorts for the first time in a while, and I think I think you can see a lot of the beginnings of the Simpsons right in there. Like, so it's some people who, I think there was some fans who maybe feel like, oh, this doesn't reflect the show as much. But like, I especially, you can see the Wes Archer twister mouths in there. I can see, like,
I love them.
The David Silverman twiddly fingers is like, as I refer to them like this. Like, how was it decided who, like, animated what there at the time? How did you set the kind of tone for that stuff?
Well, if we can quote Monty Python and The Life of Brian, we were making it up as we went along. We were just kind of like, we literally, like, we didn't have any time to come up with a finalized model sheet. And even Matt Groening didn't provide a model sheet because, you know, and Matt would say, hey, guys, I'm not an animator. I do my best as a cartoonist. I'm a writer who draws funny. And that's how he referred to himself back then. And he said, you guys, you can do whatever you want as far as, like, refining the character. And even, you know, you look at the very first sketch that Matt did that sold it. We never really drew Bart the way he had it in the first sketch. Lisa and Maggie are pretty close, but the way he did in the first sketch, we never really drew Bart that way, because we're relying on the first time on Goodnight Simpsons on that layouts. Really, he did very precise layouts. But then he sort of relied on us, and he was saying, no, don't rely on my layouts. I want you to, you know, use your imagination and have a, you know, change of staging and so forth, whatever you want. So with that in mind, we had a week to do each one. We animated each one in a week. And when I say animated and cleaned it up, all at Klasky Chupo, in a week's time, which would spill over into the weekend, which really we were working around 80 hours a week. So it was a lot of work. But we were literally like, oh, how are you drawing Bart this week? Oh, how are you drawing Homer this week? Okay, that looks good. And we were like, look, literally, it was pretty much like that. And then, you know, and over time, we just sort of like found our stride. You know, the one that we really liked, there was a drawing that Matt had done of Homer in the football short. Go out for the long bomb, boy. And there was a way you drew Homer that we said, this is kind of cool. This is good. So let's use this as a point of departure. And then I think Wes helped design the hair on Maggie and Lisa. So they had sort of more, as he called it, more architecture. So we all kind of gleaned on a different ideas and different aspects. But I would do like wild faces, like Bart getting bit by Maggie when they were teasing over the pacifier. It was sort of my face. Or Homer saying, wake up, everybody, it's World War III, and Bart going, blah! Or Grandpa faking a heart attack. I did all these sort of wild faces. I also enjoyed doing the kids dancing. I did, like, when the pagans were there dancing, and come on, Maggie, let's dance, and when they're dancing in the Bart of the Jungle.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
I love that one.
Yeah. I was wondering,
Bart of the Jungle is one of my favorite ones. Well, that's one of the later ones, and I think when you get to the later ones, you start seeing, okay, this is where the Simpsons start looking like the Simpsons on the show, pretty much.
I was wondering, though, what was Matt's input on those shorts? Did he write the cartoons as text, or did he write them as storyboards or comics? It seemed like at this point it was a very animation-driven project.
Oh, to be sure, yes. He wrote it as, he actually wrote it as rough layout. So he wrote on animation, he drew on animation paper, and he would write the dialogue underneath on the animation paper, and then from that, the three of us. Well, then Bill actually left after the 18th one. The 17th one, and then the 18, 19, and 20. Tim Bjorklund came and assisted us and helped us out rather animating on the first 20, and then the last 28 were Wes and myself. But anyhow, yes, then work out the storyboard off of Matt's rough layouts. And then we would start, you know, being more inventive. We started designing interesting shots and things. If those of you out there have seen the shorts, one of the first inventive angles, down shot, sort of a three-quarter down shot, was in the pacifier episode when Maggie runs over to her drawer and opens it up and reveals, like, there's about 100 pacifiers in there. And that we did partly for, you know, it's very artful that way, sort of broke, because we had a very flat, you know, flat space proscenium style, and here's a deep space shot. And also it really helped sell the gag, because it was the only real angle that would sell, okay, the drawer's opening and there's all the pacifiers. Sort of the necessity inspired, a more inventive angle.
Were you attached to Krusty from the start when he first appeared in the shorts? Like, was that one of yours, the Krusty short?
Yes, the Krusty, I did a lot of I think I did the majority. Yeah, I think I did all the close-up of Krusty talking, and I gave him crazy mouth shapes. I mean, really crazy mouth shapes. We even talked about the first time I think Brad toyed with the idea when he was doing Krusty Gets Busted of using some of those shapes, but he wisely decided, no, it's too much. But yeah, so I did. Well, that was the other thing too. You know, they had these really strange mouth shapes. We're just experimenting, you know, we were just seeing how far could we take it and make it look kind of, you know, weird and artful and interesting and crazy. And you know, we'd always say, ah, it's too much, or Matt would ask us to tone this down, or you know, this is funny, keep this in, and so forth. And we just, you know, it was great because we really had this whole time to experiment in animation that was going on to a prime time show on a new yet major network. So I was like, this is amazing, this is like incredible that we can have this platform to do this sort of stuff. And, you know, we had no idea if anybody was noticing or liking it or paying attention. We didn't know. There was no real press on it. We just kept at it.
So when did you find out The Simpsons would become a half-hour show? Because it seems like the production of the shorts must have overlapped with the production of the first season in some way.
Not exactly, but that's sort of the illusion, because the things were broadcast. You know, when we did the first quote-unquote season of the Tracy Ullman show, we did 20 shorts in a row, working from March to mid-September of 87, but they did not air all of them because I think they had fewer episodes of the show to air, or you know, we didn't, they weren't in all of them, all, because we also did the N.K. Browns, Dr. Janice Umgagatu. We did about seven.
Oh, wow.
We did eight, and I think one was not aired. So yeah, I think we did 28 shorts in the beginning. And in any case, actually early on, you know, we were asked, Matt, you know, what does Homer do for a living? And he works at the nuclear power plant. We thought that was hilarious. We were in 87, so he had some thoughts about it. James L. Brooks always says that one of the reasons why it became a short was just because I met him at, I think, the first Tracy Ullman show party on April 19th, 1987, and or something around like that. Maybe, mm-hmm. I think it was that, but the night of that broadcast, was that where you saw the Simpsons? And he describes me, you had a few to drink before you met me. You had a cup of courage. Although maybe he said, it was, yeah, you were pretty drunk. And I said something to him. I remember saying to him, I wanted to thank you for giving us an opportunity to do some really interesting adult animation on a primetime show. And I might have said, I bet this could be a show of its own or something like that. But he insists that gave him the first sort of like thought in his head that, yeah, maybe this could be a show as well.
Wow.
And Matt, I think, always wanted it to be a show. And I think they had tried to develop it into a show. But I'll tell you what probably really helped that happen was the success of Who Framed Roger Rabbit in the summer of 1988.
Yeah, that's...
And I remember...
I recall that is... That maybe this is just me with rose-colored glasses of childhood on, but that was when, like, in the late 80s, that's when I discovered animation. It felt like there were a lot more... after Roger Rabbit, there was a lot more celebration of cartoons, and especially like documentaries on Termite Terrace or
absolutely. Yeah. No, that was a turning point. Roger Rabbit was the absolute turning point. And I knew it. I heard about it being produced. I had friends like, you know, I went to school with Shane Black and Fred Decker and Jim Hertzfeld and Ryan Rowe at UCLA. And Fred had been directing, and he heard a lot about what was happening with Roger Rabbit. And when he's telling me about it, I said, oh, I can't wait to see this. It's going to be amazing. And also, I knew people that went there. Tom Cito and I had become friends through my friend Eric Goldberg. Eric and I had met back in 74 when we were still teenagers. And I'd heard things about it, and I was really looking forward to it. And when I saw it, I think I started annoying all my friends because I'd say, oh, this is great. Animation, blah, blah, blah. Animation's going to be coming back. Blah, blah, blah. I'd say, oh, great, David, we get it. Shut up. but I remember that too. And I saw that and I said, you know, I bet we heard rumblings about maybe The Simpsons would be a series. And I thought this would definitely help. And then I started hearing about, you know, they were trying, you know, there are other things that were being developed that didn't work out. There was, I think, Hollywood Dog was developed into a series. Maybe they had a few episodes. That's my favorite was something called The Jackie Bison Show. How about a bison that has a talk show? And I said, okay, well, I guess if you think that's going to work for an adult audience, I don't think so. It sounds like a kiddie show. But, I mean, it could, if it was more ironically done, it probably could have worked out. But although... Jackie Bison is not perhaps the greatest name ever. But these things were being developed after Roger Rabbit. And I think I heard that they wanted to do Hollywood Dog like Roger Rabbit animation and live action on a TV show budget, which at that point was wildly pie in the sky, impossible to do, you know, financially. But I think by the end of 88, we basically heard that, yeah, this is going to be a series. The other thing that happened at the end of 88, which was rather interesting, is that Butterfinger had us do two commercials. And that was actually, you probably know, that was where Milhouse first came onto the scene. He was not in the shorts, but he was introduced in the first Butterfinger commercial. Hey, Bart, want to trade lunches? And I directed the first one, and Wes directed the second one. We sort of broke it down that way.
That reminds me. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is kind of an esoteric question, but in that first Butterfinger short, Bart has a green shirt, and I remember in some other ads, Bart would have like a blue shirt. Was there a reason for the change in shirt color in some of those commercials?
Ah, that's a great question. And to that I answer, I don't know.
Okay. We'll never know the mystery of the green shirt.
I don't know. Perhaps, you know, I can only speculate. Maybe they said, well, we're going to distinguish Bart from his... when he's pitching stuff, he'll have a different colored shirt. That's when he's in pitch mode, as opposed to when he's on the show. I have no idea. I wasn't around for those conversations. Maybe they ran out of paint. It's hard to remember. You know, I wish I kept some sort of journal, even if I just wrote a sentence, because we were doing the Butterfinger commercial. I guess we took a bit of a hiatus from the shorts due to the Butterfinger commercials. I think we were working on to the shorts all the way into 89. By May of 89, we were in development of the series, maybe April. I can't quite remember. And the first thing I was assigned to do was do the title sequence, working with Sam Simon and Matt Groening.
So
that was my first gig on the series.
You mentioned May of 89, and that's, I have one last shorts question, which is,
yeah,
in the final broadcast short, TV Simpsons, which I don't know if that was the final in production, when we just rewatched it, there is a freeze frame gag of what looks on the TV of what looks to be Matt Groening strangling a bearded man. Like, what?
I think they're strangling each other.
They're strangling each other. Yes. What?
Yes, it was an inside joke. It was Matt Groening strangling Paul Germain. Germain was the Bat's producer on the shorts. So that was a caricature. The Matt and Paul strangling each other, yes. And speaking of strangling, I think you probably know I did the first Bart being strangled by Homer in the family photo.
Yeah,
I had fun with Bart making faces at the end and then leading to that shot.
Yeah.
And I also ended up, for whatever reason, I ended up in the Bart Simpson show animating the final Homer strangling and Bart strangling Homer back, the double strangle.
What were the rules about that? Because that was not something you'd see on TV a lot, a father strangling a son, even in a cartoon. I'm just wondering, like, I know Matt Groening had certain rules for that, but was that a problem with the network at all?
No, that wasn't. And no, we didn't really have any rules. I think Matt just thought it was funny the way I did it. So that was the only rule that I had with it. So we didn't have any rules about it, really. The only thing, the rules that Matt had were he didn't want characters to be cross-eyed. If anything, he wanted to be wall-eyed. So they're a little bit wall-eyed and neutral, and if Bart gets strangled, his eyes go even further wall-eyed, or somebody gets knocked out, or they have what we call the adoy look on their face, they would the eyes would be more wall-eyed as opposed to cross-eyed.
I always love those shots; those are great.
The other rule that Matt had, which was more, I guess he pointed it out when the shorts, I can't remember, but he didn't like the maniacal look, the smiling and scowling angry eyes at the same time. Mm-mm. Because he thought, hey, it's artificial. It's hard to smile and scowl at the same time, you know, unless you're tilting your head down in a Kubrick film, unless your head's predisposed to that. But the main reason was he didn't want the Simpsons to look maniacal, is that Bart's not maniacal in his pranks. He's just impulsive. And he does it through zeal and joy, but not through malice. And same with the other characters. Mm-hmm.
So you moved on from directing shorts to directing full-length TV episodes, and you directed 5 of the 13 in season 1. That sounds like a ton of work, and I'm just curious as to how you handled the increase in workload, because it sounds like you're already working pretty hard on the shorts.
Yeah.
I guess I did it through youthful exuberance. Yeah, both Wes and I were made into directors. You know, basically we're... you guys ready to direct? And we looked at each other and said, sure, why not? We can do that. It was interesting because neither one of us had directed anything other than our own shorts. He, you know, at Cal Arts, Jack Mack and Rad Boy Go, and me at UCLA, The Strange Case of Mr. Donnybrook's Boredom and Mariner Man. We hadn't really directed much beyond it. But we kind of realized we were basically co-directing the shorts. And, no slight or offense to Gabo or Chupa, but we were basically putting them together, boarding them, and then animating them and timing them. So that pretty much is directing. Mm. I kind of looked at it this way. I was thinking, well, I know, you know, I had a handle on doing a Simpsons short, and I thought about, well, I'll think about each episode as a series of sequences and sort of break it down that way and just sort of focus on, okay, the sequence will go this way and this way and this way. And that modular way of thinking helped me get a better sense of directing the overall episode. Yeah, the first season, we were basically, Wes and I were going to be directing, there were 13 episodes. So I think it was going to, and we hired another guy, and it was going to be who had experience in directing half-hour TV. He didn't work out, as you probably heard. Mm-hmm. But Wes and I were going to be directing like 4 episodes or something like that. And each one is directing 4, and then we'd figure out what to do with the 3 of us would direct 4 episodes, and we weren't sure what to do with the wild card one at the time. We'd cross that bridge when we come to it.
Well, that would end up being Brad Bird on the... on the Krusty Gets Busted?
In a sense, it was, yes. Brad was actually brought in later. I'm glad he was. He was brought in when they were having trouble with this first director who was, quote-unquote, more established and it wasn't working out. Basically, Jim Brooks and Gracie Films said, "Well, we need somebody in our corner who understands animation, because they weren't happy with the situation. The communication with Pulaski Chupa wasn't exactly what they were hoping for." So they got brought in Brad Bird. Luckily, that was a great situation for all of us. I mean, I was already enamored of Family Dog.
Oh yeah,
the classic show on Amazing Stories. So I was delighted to meet him and become friends with him. But the one thing that this director did do is he brought in Rich Moore, and Rich Moore basically took over for him. Rich actually boarded a good chunk of the Christmas special that became the Christmas special. It was actually the Christmas episode number 8, but it became the Christmas special when they reworked the schedule. Yeah, so basically what happened was I was supposed to direct 4 episodes, and I ended up having to redo the first episode, Some Enchanted Evening, with the Babysitter Bandit. I had to redo that. I wanted to redo the whole thing, but I could only reanimate about 70% of it or 75% of it.
It's amazing to watch it, knowing that background on it. Like, I watched it as a kid and just like, it's an episode. But rewatching it, knowing that background, and also on the first DVDs are some shots from the original animation. And then when you watch it together, you're like, this scene looks like it could be from season 2. And then this scene looks...
like a different show.
A different show, yes, yeah.
Oh, I know. Exactly. Well, there was one scene that I really wanted to redo, and I restaged it, and I came up with all those ideas for when Homer is preparing to go out, going, "Papa, papa, 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 you done, a man who knows how to mambo," and then he's shaving. And that sequence I really wanted to redo. And I was very fortunate because I had Eric Stefani. He was animating that. Such a good animator. Pretty good songwriter, I understand. He and his sister had a band at the time. They did pretty well, as I recall. that's another interesting story. But Eric was so great. Eric had I think he had worked on Ren and Stimpy. No, not Ren and Stimpy. I'm sorry, Mighty Mouse. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Probably his IMDb. But in any event, he was really great. I really loved working with him. Yeah, he was always reliable. He drew really well.
I recall you had brought him back to help with drawing Mojo the Monkey in season 9, right?
I think possibly, but season 9, believe it or not, I wasn't involved because I was at DreamWorks by that time.
Oh, okay.
I have no input on seasons 9, 10, 11, and 12. Hmm. And Mike Scully did forgive me, but he really wanted me to come back. Very nice of him. But he was in good hands with Jim Reardon as a supervising director.
Oh, yeah.
Mighty good hands, I must say.
Did you feel in those early years that the writers, who had all come from live action pretty much, do you think they were learning as much about working on cartoons as you guys were learning about doing primetime animation?
I think so. I think we all were. I mean, the good news was that, Sam Simon worked in Saturday Morning. So he had some knowledge and experience of it. His biggest knowledge and his takeaway for working in Saturday Morning Animation was, "This is all terrible."
He's right.
This is terrible, and the people in charge of us having us write this way are terrible, and there must be a better way to do animation. So he was definitely the right man for the job. But yeah, we were all learning. But what was great too is it was it was this whole group of people who had a different way of thinking about comedy, and a network that was willing to take a chance with a different approach to comedy that was more subversive. Married with Children, as a that was also on the network. It had the same, had a similar vibe to it, right? Mm-hmm. A bit, I guess basically sort of subversing the traditional, comedy tropes, It all kind of, it was actually everything sort of kind of aligned at the same time. And even Sam said that. He said, this is when it was clear that our show was a hit, which was almost immediate. As soon as it premiered, and first the Christmas what became the special happened in December 17th, 1989, and then the show premiered in January 14th, 1990. Then it became like an instant hit. But anyhow, Sam was saying, "Guys, this is lightning in a bottle. I mean, you get the same team together, you're not going to replicate the same magic. It just happens." So don't look it in the mouth.
Did you have a feeling the show would be as successful as it was? Because I remember from interviews and commentaries, Fox was shy about making them full half hours. They wanted to do like three shorts or something per episode. So I feel like no one really knew.
That's the story I heard. I think Matt told me that Barry Diller, and by the way, Barry Diller and Jim Brooks were acquainted friends beforehand when they worked together in 1968 at the ABC Network, I think it was.
Wow.
And Jim did Room 222, and I think that's why Barry wanted him to come on and gave him this great deal at Fox, you know, before, you know, it was back in like 85 when they made an overall deal with Jim. But anyhow, I think Barry was like, oh, maybe four specials, and Jim was absolute. He said, no, it's 13 episodes or nothing. Hmm. You know, we got to go for it. Which was, you know, a big investment, because you have to invest in 13 episodes. Most sitcoms, you would maybe pay for four, and if it's okay, now we're going to make the order larger. If it's a big hit, you'll have to give the full order, or maybe another, you know, 10 or something like that, because you can produce them quickly. But animation, as you know, takes a bit longer, so you kind of have to take a big gamble. That's what they did.
Yeah, with all the Simpsons, the shows that came out after the Simpsons to try and hop on it, you could definitely sense, you know, you could talk about quality for one thing, but also you could just sense like there was not a commitment from the networks. Like they would air one episode of, say, Capital Critters, and then never again.
Well, you know, with all due respect for the people trying the other things, they didn't really get it. Mm-hmm. Didn't understand. They were also coming from, not only did they not understand it, they were very sort of came from a position of hubris, like, oh, well, we know how to do this. These guys, huh, well, we can do that. And it's like, well, no, you can't, because you don't understand. Like Capital Critters is a good example. The producer of that decided he was going to write all the episodes himself. Uh-huh. He didn't need a writing team. Pish posh. I am a great writer. I'll just go to the typewriter and just show my genius. Yeah, well, they're not very good. They also made both those films, like Capital Critters and Fish Police, made this remarkably hilarious and colossal mistake. You're doing a primetime show. You may not want to do it about animals, because it'll instantly say to, almost on an unconscious level, the audience will say, oh, this is a kid's show. That didn't help, not to mention the fact they were both, I hate to say it, pretty bad. Mm-hmm. It just weren't very good. Yeah. I remember watching the first episode of Capital Critters, and I said, I don't think I can sit through much more of this. And Fish Police cracked me up from the beginning. You say, wait a minute, they're fish. Why does a police station have, you know, like a staircase?
they would answer that in season two.
I think one of the first ones was, you know, there's a broken plate of glass and there's like an outline of a fish who fell, you know, like four stories or something like that. Really? Falling? I mean, if you're going to do the joke, make a joke out of it, you know, be meta about it. But no, they weren't meta about it. They just like, okay, this is happening. Like, they're fish, but what's going on here?
So many unanswered questions.
You know, that showbiz.
So was there any thought about continuing the shorts on Tracy Ullman after you got picked up for a season?
Well, you know, we tried, actually. Matt had it in mind that I would, like, supervise and direct another animator or two. And we actually did an MG 49. I think on Twitter I posted some storyboards on it that I still have.
Wow.
And it was, I forget what it's called. I don't know what it's called, Bart's Nightmare. It was called something else. But in any case, and we had this animator do it, and he animated the whole thing, and it was really bad. It just looked awful, and the timing was bad, and it, you know, it was sort of like, it seemed like it was made by some, it, you could tell it was just not made by Wes and myself, and it didn't have the same rhythm. It didn't look right. It didn't, you know, it just felt wrong. So I think Matt just kind of shrugged and said, we've got enough to do. Or, you know, Matt and Jim, I don't know who made the decision, but it was terrible, and there was nothing I could do about it. They didn't blame me, thankfully. But you realize that it was sort of interesting in a way. I said, well, I guess that speaks well of Wes and myself, and it hadn't been the first doing the Tracy Ullman show. Maybe it would have gotten as far as it did.
Wow.
Anyhow, that's what happened.
I had always assumed it was just, well, yeah, we're working on the half hour now, so we can't do the shorts anymore. But, wow.
Pretty much. I mean, that was sort of the real thing that, you know, gave us in that direction. But we gave it a shot. Mm. And it didn't work. At all. It was just miserable.
Well, so comparing working on those shorts to like a, you know, the music videos, like you worked on Deep, Deep Trouble. I believe it was Brad Bird oversaw Do the Bartman. Like, how did those compare?
Brad Bird not oversaw. He worked like crazy. He was in Hungary or somewhere animating it. And, you know, he went overseas to supervise it and follow it up and make sure it was great. You know, he did a terrific job. I mean, they originally wanted me to do it, but I couldn't do it. I was doing 5 episodes. I couldn't do a music video on top of that. I'd have a heart attack. As it was, I think at one point I said, you know, guys, I'm going to flop on the floor like a fish. And I did. I mean, that's a joke, but I think they thought, oh, David's cracking up. So, but I was just joking around, but it was a lot of work. That was the strangest part of my life is that I was getting, this is 1990, I guess. Like 2 years earlier, I just was, you know, an obscure animator working on the Tracy Ullman show. And then David Silverman, line one, Michael Jackson for David Silverman on line one. Like, what's going on here? You know, because Michael wanted me to do the video. And it's like, well, I'm going to work on it, Michael. Get to it. That's when Brad assumed the duties, and he worked really hard on it, but it came out great. That was Do the Bartman, and that was another great sort of revelation to us about, you know, directing and shots and angles and so forth.
Yeah, I think in both of those you can really tell there's such attention to detail, and it has, you know, fuller animation, I guess you'd say. Yeah. There's a lot more in-jokes packed in. It's just, they're amazing to look at even now, I'd say.
Yeah, and Greg Vanzo handled Deep, Deep Trouble. And I can't remember my involvement. I know that I storyboarded a number of things in it that he followed very closely. I've got to give it to Greg on that one. Mm-hmm. Greg Vanzo did a great job.
He's
on
great.
That. I had some input in it, you know. That's about it.
So The Simpsons transitioned from Klasky Csupo to Film Roman after season 3. Can you talk about what that was like for as an animator, as a director?
It was fine. I mean, I can't speak to the situation between Gracie Films and Klasky Csupo. They just weren't really getting along, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. They weren't having a good business relationship. So that was the point of the move. In many ways, again, no slight to anybody, but it was better for us as animators. The facility was better. It was a bigger space. I would say Phil Roman ran a really great studio. He was a great guy, really, really cared deeply for his employees and his animators because, you know, of course, he was an animator and an animation director himself and came up through the ranks. So he had much respect for everybody, and it was in many ways, I would say, it was an improvement just in the way things were run and things were managed. They were managed better. There was a better production staff. And as a director, I found that there was more assistance from the production team.
Oh, great.
That's good. Well, around that time, not to say that all the episodes didn't look great because they always did back then. I love them all. But I would say that your Treehouse of Horror 4, to me, is the best looking, like best animated episode of the series. Like what came together? Was there anything particular about the production on that one that you think yielded those results?
I don't know. I know I did a lot of animation on it. I don't know how I had the time to do it, but I did. I guess in some ways at that point as a supervising animator, I was able to, I'm sorry, supervising director, I didn't have to do as much. I don't know. I worked out and I was able to do a lot of animation on it myself. I don't know how I had the time. I think it's no secret that the scene, their dogs and they're playing poker, I basically animated it completely in between. It's because I was very much into that reading. And there were other scenes that I had a lot to do. I remember I really just wanted to get that transition of Bart from vampire boy into a bat, you know, just right. So I kind of animated that more or less. And
yeah, I was going to say that one, like, when we rewatched it for the podcast, like, I was just freeze-framing every shot of that transformation, like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it was fun, and it just worked out. The Partly too. We just had a great time. I really enjoyed doing the Chernobog version of Flanders of the Devil.
Oh, that's great! Yeah,
and it was fun doing the Devil. I was able to do a lot of personal stuff, and I designed the Gremlin character. Well, it wasn't hard designing the Devil Flanders, just Flanders with horns. but no, there were a lot of great things, and I had a lot of great artists working on it. Mike Anderson was a layout artist for me. He's great animator. This fellow Ishvan Mihoris, who's from Hungary, he's an incredible draftsman. Incredible cartoonist. So I had a very strong team as well. Although Mike always chides me that one of the first things I gave him to lay out was this scene where it was an animation background where they in the kitchen where you go from one shot and then we animate and reveal the kids. He said, "Thanks a lot, David." Well, I appreciate it. No, I love that show too. I think it came out really well. Oh, I think of the other thing too. I was a big fan of the Night Gallery, so I really wanted to get that right. The vocal readings were so much fun to work with, and I also had fun designing the paintings, the Magritte painting and some I just sort of came up myself with the Picasso-esque Lisa on the saxophone. It was a lot of fun.
I love Homer's little elbow movements when he goes, super fun, happy slide.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. And that was Brad.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Because we were all fans of Humphrey Bear in the Great Disney Shorts of the 50s.
That's right.
And that was sort of a Humphrey Bear move. Well, Brad also came up with that great little movement of Homer, popping on his toes in the Land of Chocolate sequence. That was his suggestion as well. I remember he was saying he used to do that. So I animated Homer at the beginning with the skip and all that sort of thing, and the chocolate bunnies hopping, and then animated that part and that little bit too. That was Brad's great suggestion.
Yeah, that Homer skip ended up showing up in Black Widower too with Bob and was it Patty or Selma? Yeah, so I think you guys must have been a big fan of that animation cycle.
Yeah, I kind of reworked it in that. In fact, when I was doing when we did the Hollywood Bowl in 2014, I really got a call in January that they need something for the flyer right away, and I said, okay, I can do it over the weekend. He said, well, can you do it tomorrow? Well, thanks for the notice. And I actually have a cell of Homer skipping in the Land of Chocolate. I looked at and said, okay, I'm just going to take this image and put a conductor's uniform on him, give him a baton,
perfect,
and do a sort of thing of the Hollywood Bowl. And how do you guys like this? Okay, good. Yeah, I'm really clever.
So when you meet fans of the show, what would you say is the most common misconception they have about the production of The Simpsons?
Well, the number. I'm always intrigued that people will ask me, hey, they don't know. People will ask, do you record the voices first or after the animation? And of course, you record the voices first because you don't want to hamstring the performances. And you want to be inspired by the performances and inspire not only physical performances, but hearing the voice, once they're recorded, you start thinking about, it sort of even helps your staging a little bit. I also, the other misconception is, it takes you about a week to do an episode, right? So, yeah, it's a week. Would you believe 6 months of actual production?
That's a fast one, right? 6 months. It's
6 months. When I say 6 months, I mean from the point of storyboarding to the point of getting the first back in color, but really it takes more like 9 months when you think about, well, take example, the episode that I co-wrote with Brian Kelly, but I came up with the idea and pitched to Al in March of 2017, and it airs, just aired a year and a month later. Now, we didn't start it right there. That was when the idea was pitched. We started writing it, I guess it was around June of last year. Al really liked the idea, and he kind of fast-tracked it, which surprised me. I just pitched the idea to say, I have this idea, maybe you want to do this. And he looked at me and said, you want to write it? And I was like, well, I don't know. I haven't written an episode of The Simpsons. And so he suggested, well, you might want to pair up with a writer. And I said, that'd be great. And I asked Brian Kelly if he liked the idea. It was awesome. Yeah, so the production of an episode, as you know, takes more like 9 months, from the time that you start writing it and the time that it's finished. It may not air exactly, when you're done, but although we are getting the last retakes in just before the wire.
Oh, wow.
Which we can these days. Yeah.
No, I think they're all in now
because
when I saw that your episode was airing tomorrow, I was like, well, oh man, does David even have time for this yeah. interview today? Like, geez.
Oh no, no, I'm done. And if anything, actually, I'm going actually on Monday. I'll be going to Stuttgart for the animation festival there.
Nice, nice.
I got to prepare for that.
Wow. You mentioned becoming supervising director. Did that position exist in the first seasons of the show before? Like, who was it before you, or was there not? Were you the first?
I was more or less the first. I think Gabor Chupa was nominally supervising director, but they wanted me to do that. They really liked my episodes in the first season, so and I think it was probably coming from Jim Brooks. They wanted me to be supervising director, or Sam actually, I remember, probably may have had something to do with it as well. And I sort of did that in the second season, sort of looking over the shoulders of Jim Reardon and Mark Kirkland, but they didn't need too much, you know. They're great, and mm-hmm. so, but that's how that happened. Yeah. I did more and more of that. As by the third season, they said, "Okay, we want you supervising more and directing less." And I said, "Okay, fine with me." Mm.
I think
that was the other thing too. Because of that, I was able to do more animation, mm-hmm. and that's what I ended up doing a lot of the time, where I would help people out, like doing the Blue Danube sequence for helping Carlos Baez out on the Deep Space Homer show, mm-hmm. or even Bob Anderson doing the See My Vest sequence, because that Two Dozen One and Greyhounds was a pretty difficult show.
Oh, wow.
Well, yeah, you also, in the I Didn't Do It Boy episode for Bart, like, there's definitely some crusty poses in there that I'm like, it looks like a David Silverman crusty to me.
Yeah, I seem to remember doing a few things in that one. I think I did the scene where, like, hey kids, here he is, but he's really depressed or something like that. Isn't that episode? I think that's in that one. Mark Kirkland wanted me to do the, or maybe I said I really want to do the scene with, you know, with Homer, the Power of Sugar episode, mm-hmm. the great speech. You know, I can't live the button-down lifestyle like you. I want it all.
Well, what is there a lot of saying of Simpsons quotes within the Simpsons team as well? Because I know, like, in for fans, we do that constantly.
Oh, I think yes, we often get into like little catchphrases from the show would come into our conversation. It would sort of ebb and flow depending on what episode tickled us more than the other. It's hard to recall now, but I just remember that happening from time to time. I wish I had a better story to tell from that. But the answer is yes, we would do the exact same thing. I'll tell you one thing that we would always do. We'd always say, "I don't know," with great confidence.
You did that in this interview, actually.
So, by the way, that was one of my favorite stage directions that made me laugh out very loud, because when I read that episode, it was in the Blood Feud episode, and it said, "Okay, Mr. Burns, what is your first name?" "Homer." "Confident." "I don't know."
That is great.
That word "confident" really killed me. It's so funny.
So before we go, I did want to ask about the transition from traditional to digital animation. It felt like it was inevitable for The Simpsons, but The Simpsons, it was one of the shows that held out the longest to make that change. What was that transition like as a director of animation?
Yeah, we were like the last man standing in that respect. Everyone else had gone digital. It actually worked out very well. In many ways, I was relieved, because the episode that was almost our proof of concept of it was a very good one, because it was Homer cloning himself. And what I found, you know, to my delight, is that because of that, I didn't have to worry about cell levels. You know, cell levels, it's mechanical. So you can only really have so many levels, because it just becomes you're unable to do it. So Homer cloning himself would have been much more complex if it was traditionally, you know, painted and photographed. So that allowed a great deal of latitude. And even in that one, I started experimenting with, when we came to the Isle of Dr. Hibbert, I wanted some gradation in the background and the sky color and things like that, sort of give it a different sense. And the thought of, it was interesting, said, "Oh, we'll probably only use that in special circumstances." And we use it all the time. Pretty soon after that, like, "Oh, we'll only use it just every now and then." And like within like the next year, it's all over the place. Yeah, I found it quite liberating, because I found it, that was the other thing I realized too, is that, I can do, if you look at that show, you'll see there's like a lot of sort of faux multiplane shots, where you're pushing to somebody and you have different layers of movement. So you don't just push into like Homer's face when he's gassed and says, "What's that?" when he's riding on half cow Flanders. But Flanders moves at a faster level, and Homer moves faster than the background does. So it feels like a multiplane shot. And I realized, oh, I can do this with ease on this show, because with the digital, we can do these multiplane shots. Whereas before it had to be very special. You had to actually shoot it against green, and we had to composite it on video later.
I have one last question here. So now, you know, The Simpsons is, I guess, about to officially become part of the Disney empire. And I mean, where do you see the future of The Simpsons being? Like, where do you see the show going as it enters the 30th season?
Well, I'm not the greatest predictor. People ask me, you know, when the show was starting, when I got the first script that I directed, which is Bart the Genius, I thought it was the funniest thing written for animation. I'm not kidding. You know, at the time I read it, this is the funniest thing written for animation, be it for theatrical or TV. And somebody asked me, and I said, well, you know, I don't know. It's anybody who liked the Bullwinkle show will certainly love this. I can't tell the public. The critics are going to like it, but I'll give it at least 2 years. But I don't know. In many ways, it could be really great for us, because in some ways, I would think, I don't think Disney would want to upset a ongoing franchise that's successful. So, and there's assurances that they won't really, should everything go through, that they won't upset the apple cart, which, by the way, has been their track record. I mean, they've done the same. They basically leave Marvel alone, leave Lucasfilms alone, Star Wars alone. It's sort of like, well, that's their own thing. We're going to focus on animation and the things that we do. So I'm going to guess, hope for the best.
I'll say
it that much. I don't see any downside.
And I mean, Simpson alums like Rich Moore, Jim Reardon, Brad Bird, they're having a good time at Disney.
Not too shabby. Yeah. You know, the Disney we sort of make fun of and the Simpsons doesn't really exist. That's sort of like the Disney that exists now is pretty savvy, pretty meta, pretty understanding of this kind of humor. So I don't see any giant speed bumps in the way.
Well, thank you so much for your time, David. Is there anything you wanted to plug, like maybe your Twitter account or anything you'll be doing?
I love your Twitter account so
yeah,
much.
Yeah. His Twitter account is great. I love when you pull like 30-year-old drawings out, and they're like very like fundamental Simpsons drawings that we've all seen a million times, but now you can see the original.
Well, yeah, I'm going to try to keep doing that. Yeah, because you can follow me on Twitter at Tubatron. Obviously, that's a reference to the tuba playing that I do from time to time. And if you're in Los Angeles, maybe you can catch the band I'm in, Vaught of the Villains. And that's about all I can plug at the moment. I'm also sometimes in a funk brass band, often in Long Beach, called the Sea Funk Brass Band.
Oh.
So I try to stay musical as awesome. Much as I can.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much. Great to chat with you.
So yes, thanks again to David Silverman. So great. A very busy man giving us an hour of his time to talk about our favorite show. And we got so many great stories out of him. Hopefully we can get him back one day. He is a very hard guy to nail down because, again, he is like super busy with the show. He's going to Germany to do stuff. So yes, thank you so much, David, for giving us more of your time.
Yes, thank you. And also follow him on Twitter, the @Tubatron. We said it on the thing, but I'll say it again. If you guys like following, you know, Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, because they share all these things of like, well, this is a thing you never saw from our production. David Silverman is doing that all the time on his feed. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful. He's like, oh, do you remember that picture of Krusty saying, I love my kids?
Yeah.
Here is the original drawing. This is why you saw it, because Silverman drew it on a sketchbook
and then kept it. Yes. Again, like with our other interviewees, I recommend you go on Twitter, tell them thanks for doing the interview. They really appreciate that, and they really like to hear that. So go tell Tubatron that you really liked the interview, even if you didn't, but I think you did.
I hope so.
Yes, we liked it.
And here's to more. We've got more cool interviews on the way. And thanks also, I guess, to folks supporting us on Patreon, so you can hear the cool stuff like this. We get to do interviews like this because this is our full-time job, thanks to you supporters on Patreon.
Yes, and we're talking to some Simpsons biggies about a future interview, so please look forward to more stuff. And again, like Henry said, thank you so much for the support. We couldn't do any of this without you. So we'll see you on our next interview.
infotainment.